Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
And now it is my pleasure to welcome Mandy and Maura to the Inforum stage.
Hi, y'all.
I'm so happy to be here. Welcome to the program. I'm especially happy to be here with my friend and fellow author, Mandy. As Marissa was saying, she's the author of that viral New York Times column you almost certainly read or saw or heard about, and also now of this new fantastic book, How to Fall in Love with Anyone. The question that we drew was, positive things about your partner.
You want me to read it?
And I was like, well, obviously you wrote this great book that everyone's here to hear about, but also you're thoughtful and intelligent and generous. And mostly the book, which you all should buy.
It's alternate sharing something you consider a positive characteristic of your partner. Share a total of 5 items. We thought it would get awkward if we did this for 5 items. So we were just going to do 1. But mine for Maura is that I think she's really cool. Like, we had drinks last night, and I said to my partner after the drinks, I was like, isn't she cool? And he was like, yeah, she really is. I was really excited to do this together.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to start us off by asking a little bit about the 36 questions. I know you get to talk about them a lot, but I was curious. I know you were working on the book sort of before you discovered them. It was like in your process of working on these essays that you first came across them. I wondered if you could just tell us a little bit about that and how it changed the book you thought you were writing, or, you know, wow, what the impact of becoming virally famous from this column was on your writing process. How did that go?
So I had been doing research for, I don't know, a couple of years before I came across this study. And essentially, I was interested in writing this book about love stories because I had this idea that love stories really influence the way we think about love and in ways that are probably not very good for us, that are pretty problematic. And so I'd started thinking about all the different ways that that happens. And I found this study just sort of randomly when I was like Googling things one day, and I just sort of filed it away in my brain thinking like, oh, that's interesting, but sort of whatever.
Was it like in an academic place, or where did you find it? It was just,
no, honestly, I think it was, there's the writer Lauren Slater, whose writing I really like, did an essay on romantic love for National Geographic, and so she had done a bunch of different research. And I think in that article, she mentions this study, and I had just come across it. And so then I tried to find more information about it. And actually, it's like really hard to find, like the original study was never published. Mm-hmm. It's just a citation in a later study. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I found it and filed it away in my brain. And then years later, I was out on this date, and my date was like, oh, I have this theory that you can fall in love with anyone. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. I wonder if that's true. And I was like, oh, actually, I've heard of this study. And so I told him about it. And because I had like a small crush on him, I was like, oh, you know, I've always wanted to try it. And he was like, let's do it. And so we did. I can like feel myself blushing talking.
It's adorable. There is a little confirmation, but like you presumably don't try this experiment with someone you're not open to.
Presumably, yeah, right? Like you don't suggest it or agree to do it if you're not like a little bit open to falling in love. And then I wrote about it. I was going to write about it for my blog, and I was like telling my friends about it. I have a bunch of friends who are psychologists, and one of them knows the guy, Arthur Aaron, who wrote the study. And so I was telling them about it, and they were so into it. So I was like, you know, I shouldn't write about this on my blog. I should see if somebody will pay me to write about it.
And get so famous.
And so I actually sent it somewhere else first, and they never got back to me. And then finally I sent it to Modern Love. And yeah, it was really strange because at that point, I think we had been dating for like 4 months. And suddenly I was reading about my own new relationship, like in international newspapers. I was like reading about it in the Telegraph. And I was like, this is so strange. And people would get things wrong a lot. And so it was interesting to sort of see all the ways in which people brought their own ideas to the story of my relationship and sort of found what they wanted to find in it.
What was the weirdest thing someone said?
Oh, like one podcast was like, I think it was like the Slate XX podcast. It was like Hannah Rosen and was like, oh yeah, she met her husband this way. And I was like, no, we've been dating for 4 months. But yeah, a lot of people were like, they were falling in love by the end of the evening. But actually, like, that wasn't my experience either. Like, we started dating several months after doing it. Anyway, so it was interesting to have thought long and hard about the role of love stories in our culture. And then suddenly to see my own love story, like, really exemplify so many of the things I'd been thinking about.
And were there things, now I'm already, I'm like, I have this whole script. I'm like with love, when it gets good, I'm just going to go off script. Were there things about the questionnaire that surprised you, like about yourself? Or were there questions that were, I mean, that surprised you about your partner or that surprised you about yourself that led to something really unexpected in that interaction?
I mean, I think part of the value of doing it, like a lot of the interviews I've been doing lately, people are like, so what is it about these questions? Or like, what specific questions do you remember, like learning something important about your partner? And actually, like, we were just looking over the questions the other night, and I realized, like, I don't remember my answers. I don't remember what Mark said to most of them. Like, I remember a few. But it was really, like, I think it doesn't matter, like, the questions themselves. It's more, like, the experience of doing them that matters. And they could be about almost anything. But I do think part of the value is that you learn something about yourself in the process. Like, I think that's kind of fun. And I think there's lots of research about how, you know, like having new experiences activates the reward system in your brain the same way falling in love activates the reward system in your brain. And so I think there's like real value, not just in like hearing what someone else has to say, but like hearing your own answers.
That's so interesting. And you just, the phrase reward system was making me think of all the science that comes up in your book. So you're working on this project. You write this column that goes incredibly viral.
Yeah.
You may or may not fall in love with someone you've been dating for 4 months as a result of the questionnaire. How did your research work? Like, there's so many different kinds of information and knowledge in this book. There's like scientific information, there's sociology, there's history, there's like evolutionary psychology. How did you sort of organize your research process? How did you sort of set out trying to figure out the answers to your big questions? Was there an order? Was it Google serendipity?
Yeah.
For the most part, how do you go about it?
I think when I write my next book, I'll be way more organized. But I really went into it just like, essentially, like I decided to start writing this book after my parents divorced. So they split up when I was 26, and I was really surprised, like I was shocked. And it was so difficult for me to deal with it. And I really sort of like grieved, and I felt this real sense of loss. And I tried to think about like, why is this so hard? Like, why is this the hardest experience of my life? Like, I'm an adult, I don't live at home. And the thing that I kind of realized is that it felt like the wrong ending to their love story. And so I really wanted to understand love in a way that was really different from like our conventional ways of talking and thinking about love. Like, I had this idea that all you needed to do to be happy is like find a good person, marry them, and then like continue loving them and being like fundamentally good. Right. So I thought, like, as long as you don't cheat on your partner and you don't like betray them in any obvious way, that then like you're more or less guaranteed to like be happy forever. I know everyone's laughing and I'm like, of course, that's not true when I say it aloud. But I really, I think I believed it without realizing I believed it. And so then I was like, huh, maybe like everything that I think about love is actually wrong. And so I think partly because I don't consider myself an academic, like my background is in creative writing, but I do teach like first year students how to write research papers. And so I think it just, I was like, I should just do some research. And so I did everything from like Googling to entering a whole variety of keywords into the UBC library website and just going through academic articles and just like gathering a bunch of information. So on my computer, I have like probably, I don't know, like several different folders of like bookmarks and academic articles, and like they're not at all organized, but it was just this like process, years of collecting information. And then when I actually sold the book and decided to write it as an essay collection, I kind of knew the ideas that I wanted to write about. And so that's when I started doing like a lot more targeted research. So
one of the things that's so impressive about the book, if folks haven't had a chance to read it, is the how skillfully you like weave together these different kinds of information. Thanks. You're welcome. It's true. But I was curious at the end, like at the end of the day, is there one, like clearly you go back to literature again and again. Mm-hmm. You go to sort of like evolutionary psychology or evolutionary biology relatively often. Is there one kind of research or information that you found most useful or most interesting or maybe most applicable? Mandy's writing a column now, as Marissa mentioned, for the kind of work you're doing now. Is it really just the brain scan? I just want that photo of a brain that's like red in the one part and like that's love. is there one that's more than others helpful for you?
Not necessarily. I mean, I think the thing about writing essays and the thing that I love about reading essays is that the form is so flexible, and I feel like you can just throw anything in there as long as it is sort of relevant to whatever larger question you're trying to answer, or at least like, and the amazing thing about essays is like, you don't even have to answer the question. You can be like, I came up with this question and I still don't know the answer, but I have some interesting things to consider along the way. Mm-hmm. And I feel like you can pull that off. So I think I sort of just like meandered through information and kind of, and I try to think about it with some like more holistic point of view, but all of it is ultimately filtered through my own experiences and observations about the world. And, you know, so I guess the answer, which feels like a silly answer, but maybe it's not silly, is that maybe in some ways like the most important medium is like the filter of personal experience. Mm-hmm. And I think this is what I love about reading other people's essays, is that they're always bringing like multiple modes of knowledge to bear on like the individual. Mm-hmm. And I think, yeah, I think that matters.
One thing that's also really interesting about your book is how you move, like I feel like it captures so well how family is like a filter through which we come mm-hmm. across stories about love, like inherit stories about love, which sometimes in retrospect we're like, who even told us that? You know, when we hear about like how mom and dad's first date was actually really awkward many years later. I don't know, could you talk about like the role of your family and the research you did for the book and what it was like to go talk to, you know, your grandma and your mother and your father, and what you learned from doing that was different from what you had believed before?
Yeah, I learned a lot from it. And honestly, in some ways, interviewing my family was like one of the scarier and more difficult parts of the whole process. I knew that I wanted to write about my parents' love story because it was so important to me. And just to give you an overview of this story, because I love telling it even now, they met when my mom was a high school cheerleader, and this is in like rural Appalachia and in this like tiny coal mining town. And she met my father because she had to interview him for the school newspaper when he was hired as the new football coach. And so I loved this story of like cheerleader, football coach, when I was a kid, that seemed like not weird at all. I was like, oh, it's so romantic. I know. And my mom, who's one of eight children, initially sent my dad up on a date with her older sister. And the date was like such a disaster. And this was like a huge part of our family mythology, because the two of them were just like not, obviously not compatible. And it's so sort of funny in retrospect that they ever went on a date. And then my aunt started dating my dad's best friend, who was also a football coach, and my mom started secretly dating my dad. And a few years later, the four of them got married in a double wedding. I know, it's so good. Like, it's such a great story. And then I went back. So what I wanted to do was like tell that story and just tell it. It's like, so I tell this at the beginning of one of the essays, and it's the only thing that I've ever written that just like flowed out of me. I like barely edited it. I barely revised it. It just like came out in one whole like beautiful piece. And I was like, I was meant to write this story. Like it felt like I was like transcribing from the gods. But really what I think was happening is that I had spent my whole life like revising this story in my brain. And so I wrote it out and I was trying to like think about, you know, the role of love stories in our lives. And eventually it occurred to me that I needed to talk to my parents about this story. And so I was like so nervous calling them up, and partly because, you know, the divorce was really hard on everyone, but also because I was like embarrassed by the fact that they had sort of moved on with their lives and I was still hung up on this story and like needed to talk about it. And I'm like 30 years old. So, so I called them, and what was really interesting was just like finding out all the things I got wrong. Mm-hmm. And I just had so many of the details wrong. Like I had the basic information right, but just like so many things I really, it was so much more complicated and nuanced. And I think that was like, that was really valuable for me. But I think it was also great for them. Like I think, you know, talking about like breaking down barriers to intimacy, like I think it was sort of nice for us to all rethink that story. And then,
do you have any theories of where your misinformation came from? Like, was it from Pretty Woman or was it from like Cinderella?
Oh no, I think it was just from me. Like, I think I just had like heard the story for so long, and I just like the conclusion that I ultimately came to is that actually this story is basically like my infatuation with it more than anything has to do with the fact that the story was about me, not them. Mm. And I brought so much to that story. And like, I had sort of pictured my mother as like a 16-year-old high school cheerleader, the same as me mm-hmm. when I was a 16-year-old high school cheerleader. And I think it was, and it was a little bit about Cinderella, right? Because all Cinderella stories are really about like a mild, passive, good young woman being chosen by like a man of higher status. And that was absolutely the narrative of my parents' story. And my mom, of course, doesn't see it that way at all, which she was like, it was so funny. So I sent my parents the parts of the book that were about them to make sure they were okay with everything that I'd written. And my mom was like, yeah, it's fine. And she's like, but I just want it to be clear that I totally would have like left that small coal mining town and had like this great life without your father. Mm-hmm. She was like, I just want people to know that I was like super independent, which I really appreciated. And I realized, you know, like I wanted to be chosen when I was 16 mm-hmm. by someone who had just, you know, I was a cheerleader, which I think people think is like super cool, but I was really just sort of reenacting this like family narrative. And I would like, didn't have any boyfriends in high school, and I just like I wanted someone to pick me, right? And so I think I brought all of that to the story, and that really it really was just about me. And it was about, you know, I grew up going to football games like every Friday night for the first 18 years of my life, and so I think this story, part of what was appealing about it was that it like gave me a place in this world. Like I was the coach's daughter and then I was the cheerleader. And so I think really it was more of an origin story than mm-hmm. anything else. So yeah, I mean, that was interesting.
That's completely fascinating. It totally makes sense that it's this idea that like part of why love stories are so important to us is because it gives us a narrative of like why we're here. Literally.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then we want the reasons to be good. When you were talking about your mom, we talked about this in the green room for a minute, but I feel as if, so the word feminism does not appear in your book, I think. Is
I know.
That right?
Yeah, I don't think it does.
But there are these female characters and I feel like there's this like, maybe this is just me projecting my own stuff onto your book, but there's this like implicit theme of how has the situation of women changed vis-a-vis romance from your grandma to your mom to you? Does that change actually represent more power and a wider range of romantic options? I think we're usually conditioned to think it does. If you read the book, you'll see her grandma is one fierce-ass lady.
Yeah,
I should
talk about her.
But she's like a very self-reliant woman. And like mama is, in a way, to me, seems like the strongest woman in the book, no offense, in some way.
No offense.
But I'm curious how working through these love stories also, I don't know, just what the role of feminism is in this and what the role of generations and different kinds of generational expectations is. But yeah, are we getting, do we have more choices? Are we stronger than your grandma was? Or no? Because sometimes I think no when you talk about Pretty Woman. But anyway. Mm-hmm.
Well, so, I mean, I think initially I had this idea that I wanted, like, I was so scared of being pigeonholed as like a woman writing about love for women that I was like, oh, I'm going to really just talk about everyone. But the reality is like, there's no way to write about romantic love without talking about gender and gender roles and gender stereotypes. And I think the book is like really very feminist in its approach because it's impossible not to be, is what I realized, you know, partway in. And I think in many ways, yeah, we do have, like, we are better off now. Like, so my grandmother, I write about my mom's mom who met my grandfather when she was 13 and she had run away from home and she was living with family and she was sort of like this orphan in this coal mining camp. It sounds so dramatic, but the circumstances of her life are very, very Cinderella. Like there was an evil stepmother and so she ran away from home because she didn't like her stepmother and she was living with family and my grandfather was home on leave from World War II and she met him or she saw him out the window, this like handsome soldier, and she always talks about how he had a gold tooth which sparkled like new money. That's a direct quote. but she just thought he was like so handsome and he was. But he was home on leave. He was 29 and she saw him out the window and she walks outside with us like to go get some water. And
how to fall in love with anyone, guys,
right?
Go pretend you need some water.
Yeah. For Mama. Yeah. So she walks outside and like, and he starts a conversation with her and they end up basically spending like the 2 weeks of his leave hanging out talking, and then he goes back and like fights at Normandy, like on the beaches of Normandy, and then comes home 2 years later and he's 31 and she's 15 and they get married. I know. But this was so normal in that time and place. I mean, this is a big thing that I like, these age differences and like wrestling with these kinds of things, like with my parents' story and my grandparents' story, and like, how do I feel about them now? Because it's so much more complicated. But this was really normal at the time. And I think partly that's because there are only so many people in these tiny little coal towns. But partly because, we think about marriage really differently now. But anyway, so my grandmother, so I wanted to interview her for the book and talk about their marriage because she's always described it as like this beautiful love story and just like so sort of poignant, and she's always so moved when she retells it. My grandfather died when I was 4, so after that, she never remarried. She was single for 30-plus years now, but she had many gentlemen callers, like, gentlemen love my grandmother. It's true, and she's, like, not shy about telling people, but she never... Like, she never actually had a relationship with these men, but she would form these close friendships and they would sort of, like, take care of her. But she's been, like, very upfront about the fact that, like, she's sort of remained, like, loyal to my grandfather. And so I wanted to understand that. And one of the things that I discovered really quickly was that when I asked my aunts about their... about their parents' marriage, they described it totally differently. Mm. They were like, you know, I think she really needed someone to take care of her. And he saw that and he knew that he would sort of benefit from having a wife in this particular community. Like when you get married, you get a house, a part of the coal mining camp. And so they really see it as like the circumstances were mutually beneficial to the two of them to get married. And so it was really interesting to me how different people intimate with the same story would tell it in such different ways. And so I wanted to kind of think about that. And what I really realized about my grandmother was that actually she didn't have a lot of choice. And I have lots of choice. And I think as much as I think many of us today, or this generation, like, absorb a lot of these romantic narratives, like, she obviously absorbed a lot of romantic narratives too, mm-hmm. but she had to get married. And regardless of how she describes it, the reality is, like, you know, she did need someone to take care of her. And, you know, as much as she gained some autonomy from marrying my grandfather, she also then spent the next 30, like, she had 8 children in 20 years. So, like, she spent the next, like, 35 years just, like, raising kids and taking care of the home. So it's not like, it's like, in many ways, she has this narrative about her life that implies that she has really chosen well and has no regrets about it. And yet, at the same time, given the choice between my life and my romantic situations that I've been in and hers, like, I would always choose mine.
Mm-hmm. Do you think they can both be true? It's so interesting hearing about these, like, competing narratives, mm-hmm. and how it's, like, at one level,
yeah,
women are chattel and we have to get married and they take care of it back in the day. And then it's, like, on the other hand, she has this romantic narrative. Is there a way in which these multiple kinds of stories you're talking about can, like, coexist?
Yeah, I mean, I think absolutely. Like, of course they can. And I think that's more interesting, is, like, acknowledging these different versions of the story, because my understanding of the story is then different from my mom's and different from my grandmother's. Because really the thing that I see in that is, like, if you look into the research on how marriage has changed, mm-hmm. over the past 150 years, I think the three generations each really embody different ideas about marriage, mm-hmm. as the institution has evolved.
And if you had to put, like, a label on each idea, what are the three?
I'm trying to remember the word. So Eli Finkel writes about this. He's a psychologist and his research is super interesting. But the initial term is, like, the companionate, mm-hmm. marriage, right? Which would be my grandparents. So really it's, like, a division of labor and, like, one person is bringing home money and financial resources and the other person is taking care of, like, the domestic sphere. And in that situation, especially in, like, a super low income community, like where my grandparents lived, that division of labor is really useful. Mm-hmm. And then my mom sort of got married after, like, the second wave of feminism. And so my parents had a much more egalitarian marriage. And, you know, what they say now is that people really want the self-actualized marriage, mm-hmm. which is, like, somewhere, you know, my mom's somewhere in between the companionate marriage and the self-actualized marriage. But what people want today, and what I think I want from my own romantic relationship, though I try to temper this, is basically, like, someone who helps you be your best self. Like, now what we want from marriage is, like, an intellectually stimulating dinner conversation and like the best sex you've ever had in your life and like a really great co-parent and like the chance that one person is going to meet all these needs is like fairly low. It's fairly low.
Impossible. Mark's on it. He's on it.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
So what does that mean for our generation? I mean, now I'm kind of jumping ahead because I know that you're thinking about starting a project on marriage, but like, what does that mean for us? Does that mean that, I mean, when you list it out that way, that sounds like a ludicrous and impossible list of expectations to have of another human. What does that mean for the institution of marriage?
Well, what it seems to mean is that like the best marriages are better than marriage has ever been in the past couple hundred years. And fewer marriages achieve that standard than ever.
So there's like an equality gap in marriage.
There's an equality gap. Like, and everything. It's also the other thing that there's like a real socioeconomic gap because to self-actualize with another person, you have to have like a lot of financial resources and a lot of time so that you can have date night and that you can like go to intellectually stimulating events and you can like do all the things that are good for a marriage, right? So increasingly marriage benefits the middle and upper classes and sort of fails everyone else.
And indeed, I mean, pretty much no one else gets married. I mean, I'm overstating it, but it's like the way the class profile of marriage is changing is that it's primarily college educated and upper middle class folks. I wanted to talk, since we're here in San Francisco, which is like a mecca of sexual countercultures. Historically, it's the 50th anniversary of the Summer of Love, despite the Summer of Hate.
I saw that on Macy's today, and I thought, oh, I bet the hippies would love this.
Oh, that makes me feel so bad about myself.
We're commercializing like
Macy's anticipated. You just totally threw me off my game. I'm completely kidding. It's fine. I guess, so it's like if we're I'm just curious about how, and in your book you get into this a bit later in the book, thinking about various kinds of sexual relationships we might like broadly call non-normative. So it's like whether it's queer relationships or poly relationships, what kinds of alternatives to marriage do they present? What kinds of other stories do they present? To what extent has marriage or like accepting marriage been the precondition of queer lives gaining visibility in the United States, which is like another question. I'm just curious how this factors into your research and your thinking and into the book as well.
Yeah, I really wanted to write about, so initially I had this idea that I was just going to write about like really conventional love stories because what I thought was like, they're the problem. Like the problem is the sort of heteronormative ideal. And I was at this party and this woman, I was telling her about the book and she was like, oh, are you going to write about queer love stories? And I was like, no, I don't think so because I don't think they're the problem. And I thought about that later and I felt so stupid because the reality is like so many love stories of like every conceivable subgenre are contained problematic.
Like we're all in trouble, right? Yeah.
But it's true. And so I really wanted to do the subject justice, which was scary for me as like a really sort of hetero, white, monogamous person. But so what I did is just like immerse myself in as many stories that fell sort of outside of that really heteronormative narrative as I could. And what I found is that like most love stories are really a problem and in very specific ways. So like one of the things with queer stories, so my editor said to me, like, I'm interested in how the legalization of gay marriage is impacting queer love stories. And I thought that's a great question. And, you know, the result is like, it's not that great in many ways. And the reason is because it is basically sort of now we're sanctioning queer love as long as it takes this like one path. So it has the result of really like channeling diverse sexual expression into this like really normative path, which I think is a problem. And I've been thinking a lot about, you know, hashtag love is love, mm-hmm. Which I think has real political value. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to diminish that. But at the same time, love isn't always love. Like, it's, our experiences of love are very much shaped by the culture that we live in. And we live in a culture that basically dictates that one kind of love is the best kind of love. And that that kind of love is like, you know, monogamous, long-term, marriage-minded, that like version of romantic love is the one that counts, that feels, that people consider like real love. And so now queer love can fit into that as long as it really
it's
takes
exactly that, like straight love
takes
was.
That yeah. same shape. And then like, you know, there's still not a lot of space for things like consensual non-monogamy. You know, there is such a powerful stigma mm-hmm. around that, which I think is maybe slowly changing, but like really slowly. And so I'm much more interested in like thinking about the ways in which different individuals' experiences of love differ. And I think it's important to acknowledge that our experiences of love are very much influenced by our social prejudices, mm-hmm. and that one person's experience of love isn't identical to another. Like, I can walk down the street holding my partner's hand in any town in the world and feel totally safe. And I just think, like, lots of people don't have that experience, mm-hmm. and we're not necessarily talking about it. So I wanted to acknowledge all of those things, and I hope it did it justice, but it was hard.
Yeah. It's now I'm just for 1 minute going to put on my vulgar, like, Marxist materialist hat. But it's like, isn't it also that the kind, if you feel moved to laugh, just laugh. I mean, is it the case? Because when I think about the kinds of love that are acceptable or the kinds of love that are not acceptable or the way this process, I mean, this sort of these forces of social change work, it's, and you were saying, you know, it's like, well, it's certainly a huge advance to have, you know, gay marriage be legal, but it's mm-hmm. like, what about all these other kinds of queer lives that are effaced in that
right.
process?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, it's like marriage is this institution for transmitting property, and like, it's like, is it that the forms of relationship that don't fit into that are continue to be stigmatized, like polyamory, which doesn't lend itself yeah. very well to people forming household units and inheriting property from one another and this kind of thing? I mean, is that
I
explanation?
Think so. Yeah, I mean, I think marriage is ultimately like a patriarchal institution, and even though today we might not practice it that way or we might not go into it with that those intentions, like, it has such a long history mm-hmm. of really, yeah, like you said, being about property and channeling wealth and ensuring that inheritance goes to the biological child, biological son. And so I think all of these ideas are still very much contained in the institution and in our practices of romantic love, even though I think maybe we feel like we've moved on from that as a culture. Like, mm-hmm. I'm not convinced that marriage has really, like, let all that stuff go. Mm-hmm. I mean, even my most like staunch feminist friends wanted a marriage proposal from their partners. And I don't say that as a way to criticize them. I totally understand that we've all been like sold this narrative. And like, really, if you look at like if you're walking through the airport, there's always a whole shelf like this wide of like bridal magazines And I do think, like, this idea of, like, being chosen and being special and having your big day has very much been, like, commodified and sold to us for our entire lives. And it's really difficult to just be like, I'm just going to decide this isn't meaningful to me anymore. Like, I think that's really hard.
And I think, ironically, for our generation, it's even more intense than it was. I mean, my mom didn't know what, like, a mermaid dress was or whatever. Like, it's like this sort of fetishization and fascination with all these consumer details of the wedding seems to be relatively new in a certain historical sense. Oh gosh, what was I going to ask you? I guess I wanted to ask, I feel like there is this kind of contradiction, that, or not contradiction, but like a productive tension that emerges in your book and in this conversation, where on the one hand, like, is the obsession with love bad for us? At a certain point, I know you've just written this editorial against amato normativity.
Amato normativity.
Who knows what amato normativity is? Raise your hand. I know Vicky does.
Vicky,
who else?
I know.
Come on, really? No one amato normativity? No one read it right?
Everybody write this down. Like, vocabulary word of the day.
What is amato normativity?
So this word was coined by the philosopher Elizabeth Brake, and essentially the concept is that it's the default assumption that being in a committed, monogamous, long-term relationship is better than being in any other sort of relationship or being single, and that, like, most people want that and will be happier if they have it.
Mm-hmm. And so what was interesting to me is, I feel like in a way your book is making this really eloquent argument about decentering this obsession with a certain kind of love in a way, like, you know, mm-hmm. what would it look like if we didn't define our lives in relation to the wedding or the marriage or the one other partner? What if we had a more, like, a wider range of possible lives? You wrote a whole book about romantic love, and are obsessed with it. So I was wondering about that tension. I mean, what would the world look like if we weren't so obsessed with amato normativity, with romantic love as kind of the defining feature of an adult life? And then how do you negotiate your own? I mean, it seems like a kind of ambivalence about that, because you're quite obsessed with it.
I'm, like, but deeply ambivalent about it. Yeah, I mean, the thing that I struggle with is that like, I both want to, like, dissect love stories and understand them and sort of pick apart their various features and know sort of neurochemically what's happening in my brain when I'm watching them. And yet, like,
it's red,
right? Mm-hmm. On the flight here, I watched Dirty Dancing. It was, like, one of the available movies, and I was like, oh, this is so good. Like, I also want to be moved by them. Like, I find them very seductive. And, like, I've written this whole essay, like, critiquing our obsession with how we met stories. And then I just was at this, like, retreat with all these women, and they were all telling me how they met their partners, and I was just, like, eating it up. So I think...
What was the best way someone met her partner?
What was the best story that I heard? Oh, my gosh.
Anonymous.
Now I'm blanking on these. One woman, like, had met her partner. They were in undergrad in business school together, and she was organizing a seminar class, and she got to choose who got in the class. And her friend, who also got to choose who got in the class, gave the last spot to the man who is now her husband, and she didn't want him. I think I'm getting this right. She didn't want him to be in the class, and she was like, oh, fine.
Hannah Rosen would like that. That's a feminist story.
And then, now they're married and apparently quite happy. So this is the thing, right? It's like, they are really gratifying. At least I know what's happening in my brain when Patrick Swayze is like,
it's
nobody
red.
Puts baby in a corner. Like,
I just keep saying the same joke. Y'all are going to laugh.
Like, I know why that is so satisfying, but it doesn't make it less satisfying. I mean, I think this is the thing. People are like, oh, don't dissect romantic love, you'll ruin it. But that has not been my experience at all. But I do find that, like, thinking about it as something that's ordinary is really good for me. Like, I don't...
Can you talk about that word ordinary? Because I think it's a word you use in your book.
Yeah. So I think so often we treat love like it's super profound, like it's the most profound experience a human can have. And in many ways it does feel profound, but it was such a relief to me, especially as going through a breakup, the end of this, like, 10-year relationship that really defined, like, my early adult life. It was such a relief to hear that, like, not only is love, like, predictable. Like, not only am I likely to fall in love again, but like, actually all this suffering that I'm feeling as I'm going through this breakup is also really predictable. Like, I read this article about how the brain scans of people, like fMRI scan of someone going through a breakup, is more or less identical to the scan of the brain of someone going through cocaine withdrawal. And I was like, oh, thank God. Like, I'm supposed, like, I'm supposed to feel terrible. And like, I'll get over it. And it just like knowing that it's predictable, mm-hmm. and that like, not only do humans experience, like most mammals and also birds experience romantic love. And it's just like, I think there's something really important about that. And I think we can be more sensible and we can make better choices and ultimately have experiences of love that suit us in our lives if we don't fetishize it quite as much. If we acknowledge that it's like, you know, ordinary. It doesn't mean it isn't beautiful.
Are there literally any sexually monogamous animals? I was trying to think.
Oh, sexually monogamous.
They're like,
no.
Right?
Yeah, there are socially monogamous animals. Right. Animals that bond for life. But, so the prairie vole is like...
I know about the tell about the one voles.
So prairie voles are like the... All the scientists focus on them because basically like they are socially monogamous, which means that they pair bond for life. But their lives are very short. I think it's important to keep in mind, like, they live not that long. So because I think part of the problem is we try to extrapolate how humans should be based on prairie voles and like,
yeah, you should like, rub each other a lot. That's what I remember from the prairie vole.
They groom.
It releases oxytocin.
Groom. Yeah, and they have a cousin, the montane vole, and the montane vole is not socially monogamous. Like, they don't pair bond. And so scientists have found this incredibly useful because they can slice open their brains and see the difference. And basically, like, it's these, like, vasopressin receptors that help them attach to each other, and their cousin doesn't have that. Mm-hmm. So anyway... they are very scientifically useful because they help us understand something about like biological mammalian attachment. But many people want to be like, oh, prairie voles are monogamous, therefore like humans probably are too, and like we're meant to be with the one person forever. And I think that's sort of a slippery slope. And the fact is, like, you know, we haven't gotten to the point in terms of like research ethics where you can slice a human brain open and like look at what it looks like in love. And so, you know, we can only understand that stuff so much at this point.
I'm still like, startup idea, find the prairie vole thing and a way to put it in the breakfast cereal of whoever you're sleeping with, and they'll cuddle with you forever. I'm told in 5 minutes there are going to be audience questions, so if you have any questions about any of this, you're supposed to line up, and there's a microphone over there, and Mandy will share her wisdom. So yeah, get ready to ask your questions. This is a selfish, this isn't a good last question, so I have to be sure to get to another question first, but I'm okay. Curious, we've talked a lot about stories and like narratives and how they shape what we think about love. Since we're in San Francisco again, who works in technology? Raise your hand if you work in technology.
Wow.
We're in San Francisco.
Yeah.
I'm curious how, like, so there's a lot about stories. The book's all about stories. I've been thinking about, like, media and platforms. Like, how do other kinds of structures, like the things that structure our lives, our phones, how we meet one another, those have changed quite dramatically, perhaps more dramatically than the sort of Jane Austen, Cinderella, whatever it is, romantic story that we have. How do you think about those? I know you go on OkCupid late in your book. You lurk on Facebook. There's some lurking.
There's some such
about.
A lurker. Oh, it's so embarrassing. It's shameful.
Do you think new story, like, are new technologies giving us new stories? Are we mapping the old stories onto new technologies? Could technologies give us better stories other than the Prairie Bowl startup idea, which I gift to you?
I think the amazing thing about new technologies, and maybe the dangerous thing about new technologies, is that it is easier than ever for us to curate our own personal narratives. So, like, you know, historically we have always, I think this is like a inherently human thing to do, and I say this as a memoir writer, so without judgment, which is that we take control over the narratives of our lives, and we present ourselves to other people in this sort of structured way. And we have these ideas about who we are, and we, and there's a whole branch of research called narrative psychology, which I was like delighted to find about, which is really sort of looking at the stories we tell about ourselves in our own lives. And I think the thing about technology is that we have it. It's this other level of like mediation between mm-hmm. us and other people, and so we are more able than we have ever been before to really like curate these personal narratives. Mm-hmm. And I think especially people do this with their romantic relationships. You know, it's like it's a real faux pas to post on Facebook about like a fight you had with your partner. Like nobody's doing that. And you know, for maybe obvious and maybe even good reasons. But the result is that we are seeing these like, you know, you get engaged and then you take all the selfies or you hire like a photographer to hide in the bushes.
So scary. No offense to anyone who did that. Yeah.
But so many people do this. Yeah. And so, they live stream their viral proposal.
Because we're obsessed with proposals now, I think.
But yeah. And it's not just marriage proposals now. It's like prom proposals, which like, I'm so glad that was not a thing when I was in high school. but so I think that is really problematic in terms of our own satisfaction with our own relationships. Like there's a little bit of research that suggests that when you watch a romantic comedy, you then feel like slightly worse about your own relationship. Mm. But just imagine when you're like scrolling through Instagram and it's like, oh my God, like I said yes. And it's like The Ring. And then you're like jumping up in the air on the beach or whatever, you know, like you're like, oh, why didn't my partner like, right, plan this perfect proposal?
So why couldn't the 36 questions be like okay Cupid questions?
I think they could.
Oh my God.
Well, then wouldn't we say could be a little bit same, yeah, right? Well, we would. I think the thing that works about the 36 questions is that you do them together and over a short period of time. But even if you don't do the, like, okay Cupid does this thing where they ask you on your profile to admit something embarrassing about yourself. And I think that that's like a really sort of research-based thing to ask people to do, because sort of acknowledging, like being a little bit vulnerable makes you more open to mm-hmm. Other people's vulnerability, and like it creates an exchange. It gives people something to message each other about. So I actually think like there is some value in like really sort of acknowledging like your quirks or your shortcomings or whatever, like on your online dating profiles. Mm-hmm. Like, I think that matters.
So we have usable advice for the audience. Yeah. Acknowledge your quirks and your vulnerabilities. Should we go to audience questions? Does anyone have any questions about how to fall in love with anyone? About Mandy's wonderful book?
Hi. My question is a little bit personal, and I hope that's okay.
It's great.
Okay. I was just wondering, how does being so famous for this subject matter affect your own relationship? What sort of pressure does it put on it, and has it changed the pace and direction of your own relationship at all?
Yeah, that is super personal. I thought it was going to be personal about
you. I thought it was going to be personal about them too.
No, but it's fine. I think it's a great question. It's something I like to be able to talk about, because I think a lot of people really want me to be like a love expert. And I feel a bit uneasy about doing that. It's like, I know I have an advice column, so like, who am I kidding? But the whole point of the advice column is that I'm not just like responding with my intuition. I'm actually like doing research, and I feel like I learn so much from the process. So I'm really interested in like evidence-based advice. So yeah, it's, I guess the short answer is like, it does impact my relationship in that I feel like my relationship isn't just private. It's also like a little bit public. And I am aware that there are people in the world who are like genuinely invested in the idea of us staying together. But I don't think about it that often, to be honest, except when I do like interviews and people ask about it, which is fine.
Anything I can do to help your development.
Yeah. but yeah, I think it's like, it's fine. Because I really try, I guess the main thing is I try not to position myself as someone who's like figured it all out, because I definitely don't feel that way. But I do feel lucky to have a partner who's like really game for like applying research. So we do that all the time in lots of ways that I think benefit us. The other way in which I think it's complicated is that ultimately, like, I've written this book that critiques love stories, and yet it has this ending where I'm like, yeah, I'm really happy in my relationship now. Like, there is this real narrative arc where I go from, like, not happy in a relationship to, like, really happy. And I feel uneasy about that. But, you know, ultimately that's, like, you're working with the material of your actual life. So I try to at least acknowledge that, like, you know, I don't assume that we'll be together forever, and I don't assume that we have it all figured out, and that's okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
Hey, I was wondering, you mentioned how sharing vulnerability can help people become more comfortable sharing their own vulnerabilities.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of have a two-part question. I'm curious, after the article went viral, if you saw or heard of people bringing these questions into organizations or events, and kind of how they've kind of used the questions.
Yeah, people have used them in lots of different ways. I'll answer this and then you can ask part two. But what's interesting is actually long before I wrote about them, people used, like, psychologists had used them in lots of different ways. So that, like, there's a bunch of different studies, and one is between like police officers and members of a community, which I think is very interesting and feels maybe more relevant than ever. And one is between like people of different ethnic groups. And they seem to find sort of consistently that it creates closeness. And, you know, they, in the researchers call it like the fast friends protocol. Like, they're not thinking about it in terms of romantic love. But then I've heard from people who've done it in all kinds of different environments and with different people. A bunch of people have done it at like retreats with like sort of like personal development kinds of things, or like with colleagues. And it seems to me like the consistent thing over across all these different stories is that like they do create a sense of intimacy, which I think is kind of amazing, like that they can be applied in so many different contexts. What's your cool. second question?
The second one was, I'm curious if there are any environments that help to make the environment more intimate. I guess you could maybe pop open a bottle of wine, but anything that's like off the beaten path that you've seen that brings the experience even further out in people.
Yeah, I mean, I think I think you could do it anywhere. I mean, so somewhere in San Francisco, and I don't remember where it was. Someone in here probably knows. Maybe even someone tried it. An artist like got a table and carved the questions onto a table and put it at the top of a hill. Does anybody know where this was?
Bernal.
What is it?
Bernal.
Bernal Heights.
Thank you. Yeah, and so people would like go up there, and there were two chairs, and they would go up there and like do the questions, and it was crazy. I saw a photograph. There was like a line of people, like, because it's not a quick thing. Like, I think I spent a few hours doing it. But yeah, I think you could do it anywhere. I did it in a bar, and that was nice.
Hi. So my question is around if you can fall in love with anyone, or probably a select group of people, and asking these types of questions creates more intimacy and closeness, how does one go about choosing who to do that with? Because personally, I've been a bit afraid of going through this exercise,
yeah,
unless it's someone that maybe I want to. And then also if you go through it too many times, then maybe that kind of dampens it a little bit too.
I think it does, actually. I mean, I have a friend who's done it with like his past three girlfriends, which I think is hilarious. He's like a bit of a Romeo, but I really think like the first time is maybe the best because of the self-discovery, which you don't have when you do it later. So I think the novelty like really goes a long way. You know, I would recommend doing it with someone who you believe to be like a really decent human. Because I think so much of the research suggests that things like attractiveness don't have much bearing on relationship satisfaction, and things that do matter are like kindness and generosity. And so I would start there.
Thank you.
Hi.
I've been a professional matchmaker for over 4 years now.
Oh, cool.
So I feel like you could help me and maybe some other people.
No pressure.
So I've been constantly crafting and optimizing this list of questions that I use to ask potential clients. And we have an algorithm that assists with how we match people. And I'm wondering if there was one question that I should be asking people to get to deeper level compatibility, what should I be asking?
Oh my gosh. Oh, I don't know. I mean, this is such an intense question. Oh God. I don't know. I don't want to ruin your matchmaking business.
Okay, thank you. If something comes to you, let me know.
Okay, I'm going to think about this. I'll find you afterwards.
I haven't had a chance to read the book yet, but I have very much enjoyed your Modern Love columns, and obviously this evening. It has not escaped my notice that you are young, and that many of the things that you talk about seem to me to be much more relevant to people who are very young.
Mm-hmm.
And I somewhat recently got divorced after 35 years. And I noticed in your most recent column you said, what would marriage do for us that we don't have now?
Yeah.
That to me is a very profound question. And, you know, you didn't have much space in the column, but it was talking about wedding dresses. And so I wonder what your message has to say to people who are less young than you.
Yeah. I feel like a lot of what I do talk about is really relevant to people who are young, because so many of the wisdom that I've sort of figured out through trial and error over the years is really like things I would tell my younger self. But I have talked to a lot of people about love who are in a situation not unlike yours. And I think a lot of these ideas really hold up. So the biggest thing I think is like the value of vulnerability, being willing to be vulnerable, which I think feels harder as you get older in some ways, especially certainly in my experience coming out of like a 10-year relationship, it felt really difficult. Like I did not want to make myself vulnerable to anyone after that relationship ended. I imagine, you know, coming out of a longer relationship, I think that was definitely true for my parents, that felt like a scary thing to do. But also so much of the research is really about choosing someone. So the main thing I think about is like we don't necessarily have control over the biological experience of love. Like it's very much something that happens in our bodies, in our brains. But what we do have control over is what we do with those biological impulses. And I think we have a lot of choice over like who to spend our time with and who to invest ourselves in. And I think one way to think about those choices is like maybe to reject a mononormativity, right? So like really nourishing, investing in relationships that aren't necessarily romantic. And also I think choose, like, if you are going to have a romantic relationship with someone, like, choosing someone who is really worth investing in. And I really have come away from this, all this research, believing that it is much better to be alone than to be in a mediocre relationship. And the kind of people that are worth investing in, as I said before, are people who are generous, people who are kind. These things really matter. And not only are they important, they're also things that you can cultivate in yourself. Like John Gottman, who's done tons of research, suggests that kindness is like a muscle that we can exercise, and that it just takes practice, and that there are lots of ways to practice being kind. And I think this is so relevant to our romantic relationships, but also to like every relationship that we have in our lives. And I teach an article about his research, and my students and I have spent a lot of time just talking about like the ways in which these ideas are really so relevant to just like any personal relationship. And so, I don't know, I think there's really a lot to be said for thinking about love as ordinary, thinking about romantic love as ordinary, and thinking about all other experiences of love when they involve kindness and generosity as extraordinary, and like really deeply investing in those experiences, whether they're romantic or not. So I don't know if that's at all useful, but.
A lot of pressure being last. First, for the lady who had just went and shared about her divorce, I want to thank you for your vulnerability in front of this crowd.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
I don't know where you are, but that was really awesome. And then second, I think a lot of us can agree, or at least my own personal opinion, is that culture really shapes not only the way that people develop, but also the way that we perceive and the way that we interact with others and build relationships. And with that said, and we, you know, your talk alluded to this a little bit with the perspective of technology and with choices. I think where we are today with technology, it creates a sense of potentially a false sense of choices. Some people do have a lot of options, but some people don't. And whatever the case is, technology, having everything in the palm of your hand, gives you an inflated sense of options. Psychologically speaking, there is the concept of paradox of choice too. When you have so many options, you end up not choosing. So my question to you is, based on your research, what kind of recommendations would you make for how to kind of posture your mind or even your openness towards tackling dating, which is a very elusive and complicated, messy thing with, you know, technology and cultural nuances?
Yeah, I think the thing about like online dating or like Tinder or whatever is suddenly we have this huge breadth of potential partners, but those interactions are far more superficial than like if you started dating someone that you met like at church or like the community center or on your softball team. And so, you know, I think you're right. There is a real paradox of choice, and often like online dating feels like shopping for earbuds. I say this because I remember when I was online dating, I would like open a bunch of different tabs and I would have all these profiles, and then I would like visit each one and see who I wanted to message. And I remember I had one browser window that was full of OkCupid tabs and another browser window that was like Amazon earbuds. And I was like, oh God, this is creepily similar. And so, you know, I think it's important to like always go on a second date with someone unless they seem really horrible. If they're really horrible, you know, don't go on a second date. But I think we have this idea with dating that you're supposed to feel this spark, and it's supposed to be instant, and it's supposed to be powerful. And if you don't feel that like you should never go out with that person again. And I think that is a horrible way of approaching it. Like, I really think we would, like, my first impressions historically have been so wrong. Like, there are so many people that I'm like, oh, I didn't like you at first. I thought you were, like, weird or snobby or whatever. And then I get to know someone and I like, really care about them. And so I think that's really important. I mean, a sort of funny aside is my partner, Mark, when when I first met him, he was a student in my continuing studies creative writing class. And I was on OkCupid, and we had both just gone through a breakup, and I saw him on OkCupid, and I immediately blocked his profile. I was like, oh my God, like, no. And not because I was repulsed by him, but because I was just, like, horrified by the idea of a student, like, seeing me on OkCupid. I don't know. It just seemed, like, super creepy. And then, you know, it was, like, 3 years later, I was like, he's like kind of interesting. And that was like 3 years. And so I really think like a ton of the research suggests that familiarity goes a long way toward influencing our sense of like who we're attracted to. And so I think like always go on a second date, avoid like really superficial interactions. Like you don't have to do the 36 questions on a date, but like asking like real questions about things that are interesting to you, or if you're really uncomfortable doing that, just talking about things that you're like genuinely passionate about really goes a long way to sort of breaking those initial barriers. I think, I don't know, that's probably my best advice. Good luck. Good luck for everyone.
On the subject of advice and luck, it is an informed tradition to ask all the speakers the following question. You are supposed to tell us a 60-second idea to make the world better. It doesn't have to do with OkCupid. It's up to you. But yeah, 60-second idea to make the world a better place.
So I think the main thing that I would do to make the world a better place is I would have people produce better love stories and consume better love stories. And so I would say if you're someone whose business is telling stories in any shape or form, make more diverse stories with more complex ideas about what love can look like, romantic or otherwise, and its role in our lives. And if you're just a regular person who is interested in consuming stories, whether that's movies or novels or like anything, seek out more diverse stories, because I think this really has the power to just like widen our sense of the role that love can take in our lives. And I think it also does like all kinds of other potentially amazing things, like decreasing our prejudices and helping us tune into other people's humanity. And I think we would all benefit a lot from that.
That sounds good to me. Let's give her a big round of applause. Wait.
Thank you.